The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome to the program Sharon Hatfield. She joins us on the telephone out in Southwest Ohio. Where exactly are you, Sharon?
I'm in Athens County, Ohio, which is about 75 miles southeast of Columbus.
You must be kind of near where Jonathan Coons used to live.
Yes, it just so happens I live in the same county that Jonathan lived in back in the 1850s when he was a spiritualist phenomenon here in the area.
And I see that you've written a book about him. It's called Enchanted Ground, The Spirit Room of Jonathan Coons. What made you decide to write about him?
I've always been drawn to local history. And I was looking around for a story that had a supernatural angle to it, because you might have heard of the Athens area as sort of having a haunted reputation. So I had several different legends I could choose from, but I actually settled on Coons because I found out that he was a real person and that he actually did attract visitors from all over the eastern United States. New Orleans, Canada, many different places. People came to find out what was going on at his seances.
And 175 years ago, he was probably sort of famous, don't you think? A lot of people knew who he was.
I call him a rock star of the movement. we think about what an isolated place it was here in Athens County in the early 1850s. We did not have a railroad into the county until 1856. And yet all these people came from New York, Massachusetts, and all the other places that I mentioned, and they really had a hard time getting here, but yet they were driven to come. And that was one of the reasons that I wanted to dig into Jonathan's story and find out what it was that they were seeking.
What was it that they were seeking?
They were seeking a more optimistic philosophy, I believe. Back at this time, a lot of people had been raised on Calvinism. That was a Christian doctrine that said that only certain people would be saved and led into heaven, and that all others would be sentenced to hell, and that a person had very little control over their destiny because only the elect would be saved. And so spiritualism was a more optimistic philosophy. They believed that everyone had a chance to progress spiritually even after a person had died. So I think people were looking for a more optimistic philosophy and something that they could have more control over themselves.
And what was it that he was giving them that made them more optimistic?
First of all, there was an entertainment factor. If you think about a time when there was no radio, television, or internet, a live performance was very, very important to people. And they were always interested in something out of the ordinary. So in one sense, it was entertainment, but for others, it was a deeply spiritual experience, and they came out of it believing that the soul was immortal and that they could have a more optimistic life.
Would you describe these events as seances? What would you call them?
Yes, I do call them seances. Some people would call them circles. That was another word that was used. A lot of seances took place within the home back in the Victorian era. They were not public. And here's where Jonathan was quite different, because he converted to spiritualism in 1852, and he built a separate log cabin next door to his home, which was in Dover Township here in Athens County. And he invited the public to come in to what was certainly a very action-packed, energetic type of seance. First of all, it was conducted in pitch darkness. They shut all the windows, shut the door, and Jonathan would blow out the candle before the proceeding started. He would start off by playing his fiddle. He was an accomplished musician. And then there would be a very loud drumming noise that could be heard way out in the forest. And then a band would start playing. It was like stringed instruments backed up by drums, which was probably pretty unusual at that time. And so there would be a musical program, and then on some nights things would get even more phenomenal, because you would have a horn that levitated around the room. Now, this is what people surmised was happening from the sounds that they heard. There would be a horn levitating, and a voice would come through the horn, which was supposed to be that of Jonathan's spiritual guide, whose name was King, K-I-N-G. And sometimes King would just banter with the audience. Sometimes he would pick out people and say, "You've come here under a false name, but I know that your real name is such and such." And yet other times he would deliver sermons, very serious sermons about spiritual matters.
And our medium here, Jonathan Coons, this was happening for a lot of different reasons, but one of them was the locale. And another one seems to be that his family, a number of his family members, in particular one of his sons, also possessed gifts in this realm. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, Coon said that all of his children and his wife were mediums. Over the course of time, he had 10 biological children and one adopted daughter. The eldest son was named Nim, N-A-H-U-M, and he was considered the principal medium in the family. It was said that if he wasn't there, not a whole lot would happen, that he was the major force. Also, Jonathan's wife, Abigail, was a very interesting person. She was a hypnotic subject. Jonathan Coons would hypnotize her, and she would go into a trance state and perform what we would now call being a medical intuitive. She would diagnose cases, or she would see things at a distance, sort of like remote viewing. And so she did that kind of a role for people with the health issues that they might bring to her, but also she did participate in the seances. So it was very much a family affair.
The book is Enchanted Ground, The Spirit Room of Jonathan Coons. Sharon Hatfield joins us on the telephone in rural Athens County. And, wow, this is fascinating stuff. And you don't just talk about Coons. You talk about the movement of spiritualism. You talk about the popularity of it and a number of other spiritualists who were active, and it sounds like the real beginning of this was in 1848 with the Fox sisters. Tell us about them.
The Fox sisters lived in western New York, and as you said, this movement did start in 1848 with an experience that the sisters had. Now, they were quite young. They lived at home with their parents in a rented farmhouse in Hydesville, New York. And the sisters, Kate and Maggie, started hearing these knocking sounds, and they believed that the knocks were coming from the ghost of a murdered peddler in the basement of the home. And so eventually a lot of witnesses came in. There was quite a big furor about it, and that was the start of the spiritualism movement. Now, the Fox sisters moved on to Rochester, New York. They were joined by a third sister, Leah, and then they became internationally famous mediums based out of New York City. The Fox sisters also came out to Cleveland in 1851 and held public seances. And so that sort of helped to spread the movement over to Ohio, which had a very large and enthusiastic community around northern Ohio.
Particularly around Cleveland. They had a lot of people interested. You even mentioned that the movement was so strong that they actually tried to have legislation passed through the U.S. Senate, but this didn't go very far.
That was a very interesting aspect of it to me. In 1854, spiritualists decided to petition Congress and ask them to investigate spiritualism. Now, this is not in a negative sense. They weren't like wanting spiritualism to be investigated, to be shown to be a fraud. The people who got up a petition to Congress, there were about 11,000 of them, they believed that this phenomena was worth looking into by serious scientific minds. They wanted to find out what was behind the phenomena. So some of the people who signed the petition were spiritualists, some were not spiritualists, but they were all people who were taking this seriously. And we still have a record of those petitions today, and it's a very interesting thing to study because you can see state by state who the petition signers were and where they lived. And over half of the counties in Ohio had people who signed that petition, including over 100 here in Athens County.
Wow. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. It's the Book Nook. My guest is Sharon Hatfield, and we're talking about her book, Enchanted Ground, The Spirit Room of Jonathan Coons. And the Book Nook will continue right after this. The book is Enchanted Ground, The Spirit Room of Jonathan Coons. My guest is Sharon Hatfield in the Book Nook today. And Sharon joins us on the telephone in rural Athens County, Ohio, very close to the area where Jonathan Coons lived for a time and had his spirit room. Let's talk about the spirit room. It had some very special furniture, didn't it?
It had a incredibly interesting layout, yes, indeed, and it did have some pretty weird furniture. One of the oddities of his spirit room was what was called a spirit machine. The Victorians loved their machines. There was another spiritualist named John Murray Spear who had tried to invent a perpetual motion machine, which was ultimately destroyed by a mob. And some of his followers lived in Cleveland, and they even came down to check out the spirit machine that Jonathan Coons had built for his spirit room. And this so-called machine was a contraption that sat on a wooden table that was about 6 feet long. There was a wooden frame that came up into the air perpendicular to the table, and on it, it had all kinds of bells and whistles and tin plates and copper plates and two drums. So Jonathan believed that this machine functioned as a primitive battery. He thought that it would help to focalize the energy of spirits in the room. Now, some of the guests who were there were very convinced of this. They felt that the machine somehow was charged by the spirits during a seance, and that it vibrated and that it made the sound of a roaring wind. Other people who went there said that it was not a machine at all and that it could not conduct any type of electricity and that it was mainly just a prop. So you had a very difference of a very big difference of opinion there. Now, the other furniture in the room consisted of a table where the mediums would sit, and then there were also pews for the audience, and it was very, very crowded in the room. People who would come there would want to check out the layout. They would want to search and see if there could be some kind of fraudulent machinery or mechanism, but nothing was ever found.
Hmm. A lot of our listeners are probably wondering how this setup worked. We had people traveling long distances to get to this remote area. It was a very strenuous journey, very hard work to actually get there. And they're probably thinking, well, this guy was probably making money off of this. He probably was charging admission. Explain the setup. It's really a kind of a surprise to discover what they were really doing and that they were basically letting people just come and stay at their place, and they were feeding them, and they weren't charging them anything.
This did become quite an issue for Jonathan and his wife, Abigail, because they had created such a cool environment that a lot of people wanted to come there and stay. So some people would come just for stay for weeks or months at a time and not contribute a whole lot to the household. So there was even a name for folks like this. They were called spiritual mountebanks. And they would come and stay and participate in the seances and sort of give off an aura of being an enlightened person. But yet this was very draining to the Coons because they were trying to be farmers by day, and yet they were entertaining all these guests perhaps as much as five nights a week. So it was definitely a financial drain, but it was also a point of pride for Jonathan. Friends urged him to charge admission, and he said that he would not do it because people would question his motives. And it's also interesting to note that at the time he was letting people in for free, the Fox sisters were earning about $150 a day.
That was a lot of money back in the 1850s. And just over the hill, just down the rise, I'm not sure of the topography here, there was another family that began doing the same thing. Tell us about them.
This second family was the family of John Tippy, Jr. It's T-I-P-P-I-E. The Tippies lived about 2.5 miles from the Coons. And they at first started out as disciples. They would attend the Coons seances, and somehow, which is still a little bit of a mystery to me, this knowledge was transferred somehow to the Tippies, and they started having public seances as well. Now, Mr. Tippy built a seance room just on the model of the Coons room, and he had public seances about the same time that they did. Now, several people thought that Tippy was a competitor of Coons, but I don't believe that was the case. I think Coons liked the idea that there were some other like-minded people in the area. And so when they would have the overflow of visitors at the Coons, he could send some of them over to the Tippies to help entertain and board them.
Wow, it's amazing to even picture what this must have been like. The book is Enchanted Ground, The Spirit Room of Jonathan Coons. Jonathan Coons had dreams. He had visions. And some of the things that he learned about through this process were burial sites nearby of ancient warriors. Tell us about that.
That was one of the most interesting aspects of this research for me, was looking into the connection between spiritualists and Native Americans. As you probably already know, it was a very racist time in our history in regard to Native Americans. We were taking their land. We had this whole Western movement. So we were having to dehumanize the Native Americans in order to take possession of their land as we marched westward. And so Indians were, you know, were belittled by the white majority. But the spiritualists did not think this. They wanted to get messages from Indians. They thought that that was a very useful thing. They wanted the wisdom of the Native Americans. And so Jonathan Coons believed that he was hooked into this spiritual network that included spirits of Native Americans. So on a couple different occasions, he felt that these Indian spirits were telling him to do things. And so one of the first things he did in 1852 was to dig up an Indian mound that was either on his property or nearby. Excuse me, I said mound. It was a grave. It wasn't a mound.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a grave under a hickory tree, and it had stones that marked it. Now, today we might think that that was a terrible thing to do. We might call it a desecration of a grave, or we might call it destructive amateur archaeology. But in the times that they were living in, it wasn't thought of that way. And Jonathan Coons actually believed that he was doing the spirit's bidding, that the Indian spirit that was buried there wanted to be exhumed so that this could prove that what the Indian was telling Jonathan was true.
Hmm. By the mid-1850s, Coons had taken his show on the road. They actually went to New York City and gave seances and performances, whatever you want to call it. And at that same time, there was a lot of debate about spiritualism. There were people who were for it. There were people who were against it. Coons had been experiencing this for some time because in his own area, there were people, in particular the Methodists, who did not approve of what he was doing. In fact, they burned down his barn, didn't they?
Yes, he did get quite a bit of a pushback from the local community because people did not doubt that he had real powers. They believed that he did have psychic ability, but they believed in a very literal interpretation of the Old Testament, and they felt that he was doing the work of the devil.
Mm-hmm.
So that did lead to his barn burning down very early in the process of his having the public seances. But Jonathan was very stubborn. Even though he suffered a big financial loss, he did not allow that setback to keep him from going ahead with his public demonstrations. Now, over time, there were some critics that came there, and this forms some of the dramatic action in the book, because I'd say 80 to 90% of the people who left the Coons farm after the seance experience were very satisfied with what they had seen. But there was a vocal minority who thought that the activities were fraudulent, and some of those folks did write into newspapers from time to time. And so this did damage Jonathan's reputation as time went on.
By 1856, there was a public debate going on about spiritualism. You talk about a Campbellite minister named J.J. M. Dickey, and you also talk about a guy named William Denton, and I'm sure listeners in the Dayton area will want to know about him. What a fascinating character.
He was a fascinating character. And it turns out that his path crossed with Jonathan Coons's, and it gave me an interesting avenue of research. Now, William Denton was originally from England, and he came over here to have more room, he thought, for his unconventional ideas. He was a free thinker, and he was also a socialist, and he was a reformer. He wanted to change a lot of the things that were wrong with society back in the mid-Victorian era. So he eventually did come to Dayton, and he was the editor and publisher of a radical paper there called The Vanguard.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of a family affair. His sister, his wife, and his brother-in-law were the four folks who ran the paper. But in addition to being a reformer and a very political advocate, William Denton was a geologist. I haven't been able to find out if he actually taught in Dayton or if he was just sort of a private person who undertook these studies. But he collected butterflies, he collected all kinds of fossils, and he went around Ohio as well giving lectures about progressive subjects. And so he was recruited by Coons to come over to Athens in the fall of 1856 and debate the Reverend Dickey, whom you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1856, there was sort of an exciting public event with the Christian minister debating Mr. Denton. And the debate, of course, was sort of a spiritualism versus Christianity debate, and it ended with the Christian minister shutting down the debate by saying that he found that Mr. Denton was too blasphemous, so he shut the thing down.
Mm.
But in the course of this, Jonathan Coons made a wonderful friend, and he felt that Denton was a like-minded person, and he also, Jonathan himself was a writer, and he liked the fact that that Denton could possibly help him get some of his work published.
And for listeners who are familiar with the history of Yellow Springs, Ohio during this period, they know that there were some very interesting movements here in the village. And, of course, this stuff going on over in Athens attracted interest in Yellow Springs. And you write that in 1856 at Yellow Springs, Ohio, Denton's controversial ideas attracted an eager public as he parsed theology with a Christian minister on 19 evenings. Quote, if our friends in any other place can induce any minister to discuss the Bible question, they cannot do better than call out an opponent and let them go to work, Denton wrote. Agitation of thought is the beginning of wisdom. I am prepared to answer calls of that description. And I'm just picturing this going on for 19 nights in Yellow Springs back in 1856, and I'm sure it was a wild scene.
It just shows you how much certain communities really did treasure the life of the mind, that they were willing to be that excited about an intellectual pursuit. Now, Denton also, after he lived in the Dayton area, he moved to northern Ohio and ultimately to Massachusetts. And just to tell you a little bit more about my research, I was able to find William Denton's papers in an archive in Wellesley, Massachusetts, at the Historical Society there. So if anyone is interested in studying him further, that would be ground zero, and I would welcome, if some scholar in your area was interested in following up and doing more with Denton. Now, one of the most exciting things that happened was finding out that Jonathan Coons and William Denton had corresponded, and that three of Jonathan Coons' letters ended up in the archive in Massachusetts, and those are the only three private letters I have, and those were very detailed, lengthy letters that he had written to William Denton.
Mm. And it should be noted that Denton was married to a like-minded progressive named Elizabeth Foote, and you write that Elizabeth was so radical that she dared to wear bloomers.
She dared to wear bloomers, and she had a day job at a newspaper or magazine of some sort.
Uh-huh.
So she was definitely a like-minded, a kindred spirit for Denton, and she did accompany him on some of his travels where he collected the fossils and so forth. I'm not sure, actually, whether she came over here to Athens or not.
The book is Enchanted Ground, The Spirit Room of Jonathan Coons. I've been joined in the Book Nook by Sharon Hatfield, and I'll continue my conversation with Sharon right after this break. You are listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and my guest today is Sharon Hatfield. We're talking about her book, Enchanted Ground, The Spirit Room of Jonathan Coons. I'm sure we have some listeners out there who are scoffing and saying, this is just trickery, it's fakery, it's the kind of thing that Harry Houdini would say, you know, this is just all bogus. You don't really take a stand in the book about whether it was real or fake. You talk about people suspecting that it was. Tell us what your approach was with that.
Well, I started out with a journalistic approach because by training, that's what I have done. I've worked for newspapers. And I thought I might be able to figure out whether the Coonses actually had psychic powers or not. But I soon came to realize that the story was more about the power of ritual and belief than it was actually whether their rituals were quote-unquote fake or real. And so I decided to change my approach and make it more on the line of the way that historians of religion do. So I was looking into more the cultural side, why it was that people would travel hundreds or thousands of miles over rough terrain to get the Coons message and to have this experience. So that was more my focus, although I think it's safe to say that Jonathan Coons did assist the spirits in their physical manifestations. He was involved with that, and he had a really hard time finding his own voice, which is something I think all of us can relate to. He had ideas that were so radical and so shocking about Christianity, about evolution, that I think sometimes it was easier for him to say that the spirits had told him this as opposed to being able to really own the material. And later in life, he was more able to do this.
I think that we have many listeners out there who have various beliefs, and some of them think that it's possible to make contact with those loved ones who have left the physical plane. And there are a number of accounts in the book about people who came to the spirit room trying to make contact with their dead wife or their dead child. And it's fascinating to read this and to hear the examples of people being touched by a hand and looking at the hand in the darkness and seeing that it looks just like their mother's hand. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Yes. One of the more unusual aspects of the Coon seance was occasionally there would be materializations or actual hands, depending on how you look at it, that would be lit up by a phosphorus solution, which would glow in the dark. The hands would come out of the dark and write messages to the audience. And as you said, some people did feel that those were the materialized hands of their dead loved ones, which my approach to this is just to put the information out there and to let the person who reads the book decide how they feel about that. I will say that I'm very respectful of other people's religions, and I feel like that there was a lot of sorrow and grief that people were trying to address through the movement, and that was a big reason that they came to the Coons farm for consolation.
You just mentioned the writing. This is another amazing aspect of this, the writing, that some of it was happening very fast. Some of it was indecipherable.
Well, in the beginning, Coon started out, once he converted to spiritualism, he started doing automatic writing. And he actually himself talks about this. But at first, he wasn't able to decipher what he was writing, but over time and practice, then he became able to do this. Now, it becomes a question of how how did they possibly, these hands, write out things in such a rapid manner? And that's a question that I really can't answer, but there is a sort of an amusing story in the beginning of the book where a man who's a French speaker comes to the Coons farm from New Orleans. He's a native of France, and he's also a mesmeric doctor. He believes in, you know, this invisible fluid that has a power behind it. And he gets a message from one of these hands, and it's written in rudimentary French.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's completely blown away by getting this message written in French. And he has his doubts in some ways about the validity of the seance, but on the other hand, he's convinced that no one else besides him would have known French, which is sort of a cultural assumption that may not have been justified.
Okay, so the spirit room was happening, but not for that long of a period. Eventually, Coons and his family left the area. Tell our listeners what became of Coons.
Well, as you had mentioned, the Coons family took their demonstrations on the road in early 1856. They were not as successful, and they did not attract as much fame. And so they eventually quit giving the public seances, and they moved to southern Illinois in 1858. By this time, Nim, the eldest son, had married. He and his wife and all the other surviving children moved to southern Illinois with Abigail and Jonathan. They kept practicing spiritualism for at least a couple more generations. And they, but Coons lived a private life in Illinois. He never did any more of the public performances. They more or less had their observances within the family.
And late in life, he published kind of a weird autobiography that really didn't talk very much about the period in Athens.
I was so disappointed when I got a hold of the book. At first, I was very excited because Coons' book called Truth Seeker's Feast was published when he was about 70 years old, and he lived to be 81. And in this book, he talks about the Council of Nicaea and some very, very obscure kind of a critique of Christianity back in, you know, the early period of the church. And he says very little about his own time in Athens County, but at least he was able to find his voice in a certain way.
Shades of the Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown, eh?
Yes, he did have some similarities to Dan Brown's book because he felt that Jonathan Coons and Brown's novel both put forth the idea that some early Christian texts were suppressed that would have given us a different view of Christianity. So he did have that philosophy at a time when a lot of the discoveries that Dan Brown knew about had not been discovered back in Coons' day, yet somehow he was in tune with this information, and he very much believed that people should look into their own divine nature, which is sort of a Gnostic idea.
By the end of the book, and we see what became of Coons, you leave readers with a feeling that this movement was meant to make our lives better, to make us feel better about ourselves and about our place in this world. Am I reading that right?
That's a very good reading. I believe that his whole notion of being able to progress spiritually, even after death, was very powerful. It still is powerful to people because we do have what was later called the New Age movement. We also have a lot of people in this day and time that would describe themselves as spiritual but not necessarily into organized religion. So it was a powerful message. And I think the idea that the soul is immortal and that we can participate in our own spiritual evolution is still a very important idea.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is Sharon Hatfield. We've been talking about her book, Enchanted Ground, The Spirit Room of Jonathan Coons. And you do an excellent job of showing us how these other spiritualists ended up, what became of them. The Fox sisters, whoa, that was bizarre. When the one sister renounced it all and said it was a fraud and then went on and said, no, I needed money, it wasn't a fraud. And then you have that other family that was in the same area in Athens County, and they ended up somewhere out west like Kansas, and some of them became criminals.
Well, it's sort of an accident of geography, maybe, maybe not. But the Coons family, they did quite well when they moved to Illinois. One of them became a mayor. Another became a medical doctor. But the Tippies moved to Bleeding, Kansas. That was an area where there was a lot of warfare leading up to the Civil War because you had pro-slavery and anti-slavery forces engaged in guerrilla warfare there in Kansas right at the time that Tippy relocated his family there. And I think it definitely had a tragic effect on some of his older children who had to grow up in that environment.
We also learn about the Davenport brothers, and they sound like the true rock stars of the movement.
Well, the Davenport brothers were more famous than Coons. I will have to admit that. They were two brothers out of Buffalo, New York, who originally were favorites of the spiritualists, and they took the whole idea of the hands and the trumpet even a little bit further. They developed what was called a cabinet, and they would have people tie them up. The Davenport brothers would be restrained by ropes, and yet the hand would come out of the cabinet, the trumpet would come out, and there would be a performance. So they were more famous, but over time they were also shown to have been doing fraudulent things, and eventually they just became very accomplished stage magicians, and they did not stick with the spiritualism angle of it, but they were world-renowned.
As we open the book and we look at the back of the dust jacket, the inner flap there, there's a photo of you, your author photo. And then beneath you, there's a very haunting photo of your ghostwriter.
Well, Coons and I have been together now for about 8 years. And I have gone through different relationships with him over time and kind of still I'm trying to figure out what motivated him to do the things that he did. And in the end of his autobiographical writing, he says, "I was the odd sheep in my father's flock," which I was thinking about this the other day. Maybe that was his way of saying I was the black sheep of my family. But he was definitely out there. He was testing ideas. And he was certainly a charismatic figure that I still have not entirely figured out.
Sharon, I see you're also the author of a book called Never Seen the Moon, The Trials of Edith Maxwell. Who was Edith Maxwell?
She was a school teacher who lived down in Wise County, Virginia in the 1930s. She was accused of killing her father, and she became a feminist cause celeb in the 1930s. And so it's a true crime story, but it's also a sort of history of a Appalachian region in the 1930s.
You have a wonderful regional accent. Where did you get that?
Well, I grew up in Lee County, Virginia, which is in the mountains. It's as far from Northern Virginia, Alexandria area as you can get and still be in Virginia. And it was a farming area, that I grew up in there, and I've lived in Ohio for many, many years, but people tell me I still have my Southern accent.
Mm. When we opened the interview, you alluded to the fact that that area there in Athens, Ohio, is known to be haunted in some ways. I've heard about the Halloween stuff that goes on down there. I've heard about the insane asylum. And I learned in your book that in the area where Coons used to live, this didn't surprise me, but I hadn't heard of it. There was sort of a hippie commune in that area. Tell us about that.
Well, there have been different waves of spiritual or creative activity in this specific area in Dover Township where the Coons farm was. And one of the groups came in the 1870s and had a spiritualist community there for about 5 years. But more recently, in the 20th century, there was a professor from Ohio University. His name was Ethelred Eldridge, and he started an intentional community on the same spot where, nearby probably, we don't know exactly where Coons live, but the same neighborhood was where Ethelred started his artistic community, and he became very well known for his own artwork, which was very avant-garde, and he just recently passed away last year.
And you're down there by the Fur Peace Ranch. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, I've been over there to the concerts a few times. It's a very nice place, and I know that they also teach music lessons as well as have the performance space.
Well, Yorma, the former guitarist with Jefferson Airplane and Hot Tuna, who is there at Fur Peace, that's his place. He spent some years. He had a brief collegiate career right here in Yellow Springs. He went to Antioch College.
I was not aware of that connection.
Yeah, well, we're all connected somehow, aren't we, Sharon?
Isn't that the truth?
Mm. Well, this is a fascinating book, and we really appreciate you spending some time with us. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners here in Southwest Ohio?
I'm just really thankful that I had the chance to tell this story, because if you think about the many alumni that have passed through Ohio University over the years, I'm just was really surprised that no one else had written in detail about Coons, and so I was just really happy to be the one to tell the story. And I do feel like that there are some connections with the spirit of Yellow Springs and all the alternative movements that have gone on there, as well as here in Athens.
Mm. Yeah, I feel that too. And I must say that your publisher, Swallow Press of Ohio University Press, did a really fabulous job on this. It's a beautiful cover. The whole thing is very nicely done.
Thank you. I will pass that along to the designer.
My guest has been Sharon Hatfield. Her book is Enchanted Ground, The Spirit Room of Jonathan Coons. You heard about it in the book nook. And Sharon, thanks again for being my guest.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me on the program.
And tune in again tomorrow. We'll bring you the Book Nook at 10:30 on Sunday morning. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.